Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Butchers throwing their food waste in streets or waterways, or clamp down on pigs from roaming in the streets and kind of eating bits of offal that would have been dumped there. The butchers have to make contracts with leather makers so that, or the other way around, so that they can collect this leftover animal product. But yeah, it's a very messy history. and like I say, you know, from the medieval era onwards, you get many angry authorities trying to manage the butchers who, just because they've got so much, they just throw it into the streets, right? You know, food waste on this mass kind of capitalist globalized scale is, of course, a modern issue, but it wasn't as wonderful as we might assume.
Refrigeration, frozen food, canned food, all this on our fingertips. Imagine a world that none of the above were available. What would we do with all the glut and abundance of produce? How would you have your pasta with tomato sauce in the winter? The problem of refrigeration, it was something that even Einstein was trying to solve back in 1926. Einstein and Szilard, they patented a new refrigeration device in the 1930s. They were trying to improve home refrigeration technology. They made an absorption refrigeration with no moving parts, which operated at constant pressure and without electricity, but this one was never commercialized. Hello, my name is Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Welcome back to another food adventure through space and time.
Everything in its place. That's easy. With my Frigidaire cold pantry. So true, Mrs. Doughty. In your Frigidaire cold pantry, there's a place for all your food. Fresh and frozen, canned, bottled and wrapped, new bought and leftover. They're all right there, and they're all at your fingertips. Let's start with the most ingenious door in any refrigerator. It has special places for bottles, spreadable butter, cheeses, even leftovers, and a big picture window hydrator for fruit.
We all know how good a fresh fruit or a vegetable tastes, just plucked from the ground or from the tree. And we are also so used of having fresh fruits winter, summer, and every season, and any kind we like, from strawberries to apples to oranges, melons, grapes, and so on. Yet, these two extremes of our food systems, having your own freshly grown food all the time, or being able to buy fresh fruits and vegetables all year round, are not the norm. And in a sense, throughout history, they weren't the norm as well. Even fresh food for people who lived in cities was more difficult to access anyway. Inherently, the problem always was a problem of waste and leftovers. What do you do with an abundance of fresh vegetables in the summer and nothing in the winter? What will you do when you slaughter an animal? Are you going to waste some of it? Is it some of it going to spoil and thrown away? Inherently, humans always had this dilemma and these questions, and they found ingenious ways to solve it. Wasting food was always a morally charged issue, something challenging. And let's not forget that this fake age of abundance that we live now, it didn't really exist before our very modern post-World War II era. So with the technologies of canning food and of frozen food and refrigeration that came into our lives, people were able to save food and not waste and have more fresher food, but also at the same time, as these things grew and grew and grew into huge industries, using more energy and more resources, also means more possibilities for wasting food throughout that chain, if food comes from very far away, and so on. We are aware of our food waste nowadays. There is more awareness about it because of the climate crisis and the environmental issues. But this is not a new problem for humanity, as I said earlier. It was always the case, even when there was far less of a product to go about, and there were ingenious ways of preserving it, like salting it, pickling, or sugaring, or drying and smoking. And this is what the new book from Eleanor Barnett is all about, Leftovers. She shares with us the untold story of food waste and preservation in Britain specifically, from the Tudor era to the present day, and of course, the future too. So the book is released tomorrow, 14th of March. So please enjoy our conversation about her new book. Dr. Eleanor Barnett, welcome to the Delicious Legacy Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's very good to have you here. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you? What do you do? And how did you get involved with food history?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a food historian. I use food as this particularly engaging, enlightening kind of lens through which to access the daily lives and values of ordinary people in the past, as opposed to kind of solely thinking about, you know, the history of kings and queens, for example. It's this amazing tool to access, yeah, what people's identities were and what they were doing day to day. In particular, what my PhD was on and now what I kind of work on as a researcher at Cardiff Uni is the links between food and different religious identities in the early modern period, which of course is this time of great religious change. So you have the Reformations, time of globalization, colonization, and food exchange between people of different countries and cultures. But my second area of expertise and what my new book Leftovers is all about is the history of food waste and preservation.
Brilliant. Thank you. So Eleanor, tell me a little bit about your new book. What is it about?
Yeah, so Leftovers looks at the many ingenious ways that people in the past have sought to prevent food from going to waste in Britain. So thinking about how they've done that through preservation, using up leftovers in creative new dishes, and then recycling or reusing the food scraps that they ended up not eating. So asking how food waste has been understood in the past and why people wasted food. And in doing so, I end up exploring a whole range of themes that we can talk about, you know, from religious belief, food and gender divisions, wealth and inequality, and yeah, of course, of climate change and environmentalist movements.
Mm, lovely. That makes a lot of sense, because we as a species, generally, not only in this country, but we forget that our very much abundant phase of food is very modern. It's very recent, like after World War II, and especially the last 40 years or so. Before that, there was always a fight between feeding and constantly trying to find new sources of food and preserving the food in many different ways. Even up to the 20th century, really. Like, we forget how recent the whole thing is, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think we maybe had a taste of what life could be like in the pandemic, or what life was like for some people in the past. And we all started not wasting as much food. But interestingly, I think very quickly after the lockdowns, we then went back to our previous levels of food waste.
Mm.
So perhaps that says something about human nature.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it might have been a little bit better, but clearly not. Yeah, because during lockdown, we basically, there was shortages, right? For many, many reasons, yes. Of course. Yeah. So people made their own bread, they're trying to buy flour and make sourdough, they did their own cakes, they're trying to do a lot of preserves and stuff, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and I think people just valued food more because we had less access to it. You know, it was a shock when we went to the supermarket and there were limits on certain items.
Yeah.
Or some things were just, you just couldn't get anymore. And lots of people ended up growing their own food as well, you know, even if just on a windowsill in a window box, that sort of thing. We very quickly went back to kind of modern life and all the sort of rushing around and commuting and things that mean that we just don't have the time or the mental energy really to think about food and food waste, unfortunately.
True, that's true. So, I mean, food waste is a pretty much interesting topic in itself, but also very, very current, very, very in vogue because with what's happening in the world and climate crisis and food poverty and food waste. So was this one reason that you came about writing this book? How did you come about thinking of having a book about food waste and history? And
yeah, no, definitely. So I see food waste a lot in the news. So stopping food from going, ending up in the bin is obviously a huge part of the modern fight against climate change. Perhaps you're familiar with I think the main statistic that you kind of see thrown around is that a third of the food we produce globally today goes to waste. And if all this, yeah, it really, if you think about it, that is crazy, right? A third. And if all of that needlessly discarded food were a country, it would be the third biggest emitter of greenhouse gases after China and the US. So it really is a huge modern day problem. And obviously, as a food historian, I started thinking, you know, how has food waste been understood and managed in the past? You know, how did we end up being such a wasteful society? And what might studying people's leftovers kind of tell us about our shared history, you know, and what can we learn from it? And I was quite surprised, actually, that there really is very little historical research on this topic, despite the fact that it's so pressing and topical.
Right, I see. Because I grew up from a family that obviously they were all saying, don't waste your food, eat your food and all that stuff. And I grew up with both my grandparents, maternal and paternal, especially my grandmothers. They were always creating food from a very scant ingredients, very little stuff. And they always used to tell us stories about Second World War in Greece when there was basically famine because the German Nazis, the occupation, they were taking all the food. And I remember one of my grandmothers saying they had just dry bread from the bran of the wheat, made just that, and some basically sesame oil, which obviously for Greeks is not it's not a good quality oil. And that was it. And it was countless stories and countless days of of that. So their food waste was minimal, and that's only like a couple of generations ago. And yet today, you say about a third of all food, which is mental. So yeah, for me, yeah, food waste, it's something that obviously I see it in the news. I'm trying not to, I don't really have much food waste, but yeah, we do produce a lot of food waste. So thinking about previous generations, I'm not so sure how much food was wasted. I would have thought that it was very little, I suppose, like historically.
Yeah, so there are certainly periods of history when, like the Second World War, which maybe we could talk about in a bit more detail later, where, you know, there was this urgency about reducing your food waste and the government and the state stepped in as well to enforce rules. But more generally, people were used to living in kind of, I suppose, within their means in a smaller food system than we are today. So of course, today you kind of go to the supermarket and there's just endless things, right? There's endless packets and you kind of forget that in the past, you would have had to grow your own food, preserve your own food, slaughter your own animals. And so when you had that kind of value behind food, you wouldn't have wasted so much. I think that's the big difference from today. But I do think a lot of people might assume that this book is going to be one that tells you to stop wasting food by going back to kind of the, you know, good old days. And that's not quite what it is. So there are, I kind of wanted to show that the reasons that we waste food actually still do echo throughout history. So to take one example, if we go back to the Tudor times, kings and queens would have had access to far more food than they could possibly eat. And they would have had, you know, huge tables with big meat pies and endless sugar courses with sugar sculptures and all this sort of thing. And meanwhile, the poor would have been struggling and to kind of glean scraps from the harvest, or they rioted because they didn't have access to enough bread to sustain themselves. So like today, I think when people have access to a lot of food, they tend to waste more of it, even if that's at the expense of the poor, for example.
Yeah, that's always a risk. It was always a constant risk. I mean, yeah, we forget that people were always on the verge of starvation for long periods in the past. And you had to find ways. When you have fresh food will go off for various reasons, not because you're a wasteful person or a wasteful society, right?
Yeah, of course. The other thing is that artificial refrigeration is a very modern thing. You know, the majority of British homes wouldn't have had a fridge or a freezer until the late 20th century. So, of course, they had to come up with other ways of making their food last longer, you know, through sugaring. So if you'd sugar fruits or vegetables, you know, making pickles, fermenting, dehydrating, all of those kind of traditional ways of storing your food that we've, I think, kind of lost touch with a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we still eat pickles, I suppose, and some preserves like jams and marmalades. But it's more like factory manufactured mainly. We do tend to buy the stuff ready and we have it as a complement to our myriad of fresh food and selections from supermarkets and so on, right? So basically preserves such as pickles and jams were quite a significant amount of calories and food in the past, wasn't they, part of the diet?
Yeah, definitely. It would have been, and not just pickles and preserves, but things like cheese. We forget that cheese is a way of preserving milk. So lots of the kind of everyday foods were actually preserves. I mean, even butter is a way of preserving milk, if you think about it.
Mm.
Yeah. And of course, until, you know, relatively recently in our history, food was grown locally and you had to be reliant on the seasons. So you just wouldn't have thought that you could get fruit throughout the winter, right? So it was an important part of, for example, in the Tudor era, it was sort of wealthy gentlewomen. A big part of their sort of ritual year, I suppose, was collecting the fruit from their orchards or gardens from the autumn and then preserving them in sugary preserves so that they could have those amazing flavours throughout the winter period. If you were poorer, or you might have had like a kind of a pig, a cottage pig.
Yeah.
And you would have slaughtered that in the autumn and then, you know, eaten what you could then, but you would have preserved things in brines, you know, even preserved the bones so that you can use them later.
Mm. So in your book, how far are you going back trying to find history of food waste? What's the periods you're covering?
Yeah, so it's a big history. It starts off in the Tudor kitchen and it goes all the way to the present day. So, you know, we're going through Industrial Revolution, Agricultural Revolution, the Victorian era, the pandemic as well, recently the World Wars. And then I kind of end by thinking also about the future of food as well.
I see. Yeah. Obviously, the main part of preserving in the past and not wasting food was pickles. And that's part of your first chapter in the book. So we're talking about pickles and salt and cheese and all these different preserves. And then on the second chapter, you're talking about Muckill, skins and entrails. That's the title of the... Tell us a little bit about what this chapter covers, basically.
Yeah, so if the first chapter is more about how was food waste understood and what do they do with their leftovers kind of in the household, the next chapter thinks about inedible bits of food waste. So think about, you know, apple cores, bits of animal carcasses that can't be eaten. And in doing so, I kind of end up telling a story there about the rise of public health initiatives that clamp down on things like butchers throwing their food waste in streets or waterways, or clamp down on pigs from roaming in the streets and kind of eating bits of offal that would have been dumped there. So yeah, that's the other thing about this topic, that it's one thing thinking about food waste in our homes, but of course this is a wider issue with kind of the development of industries, food industries, and what do they do with their food waste. So that's another story that I tell throughout the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Which we're going to check a little bit later on. And you forget, obviously, as a person, as a reader, or as a, someone who cooks every day, we forget, okay, one thing is to preserve stuff, another thing is to eat all our fresh food or share it equally and all that, but also all the inedible stuff that's left over. So they are part of a system that can be good one, like using all these remains, or it could be wasteful. And I believe in the past, this was more of a, like you could use the skins, or as you said, the bones earlier on, or you could make shoes and clothes and all that stuff. But as this process kind of went away from the home, from the small artisan industries, and went to bigger and more industrial size, with thousands and thousands of animals being slaughtered every day, then this basically waste, what happens to it? I mean, do we know? I mean, is this used, or is it been just thrown away, and that contributes to all this environmental mess and to the food waste that you're talking about?
Exactly, yeah. So it is a big problem that the kind of government and state has to get involved in to kind of manage, because like you sort of suggest, before these bigger industries developed, you'd have one pig to slaughter, right? So you would use everything that you could from that pig, you know, even the fat, you would make it into a tallow candle, which was the only light that you would have access to before artificial, you know, electric lights. Mm-hmm. But then the candle makers develop on an industrial scale, leather makers industrial scale. And so it's a history of what are the kind of connections that they build up amongst themselves to make use of all of those animal products. So the butchers have to make contracts with leather makers so that, or the other way around, so that they can collect this leftover animal product. But yeah, it's a very messy history.
Yeah.
and like I say, you know, from the medieval era onwards, you get many angry authorities trying to manage the butchers who, just because they've got so much, they just throw it into the streets, right?
Right. So basically, as a civilization, as a society, we were always a bit messy and wasteful, one way or another, really. There's no rose-tinted glasses that the past was better.
Yeah, I think it's just more complex than that. And I do think people, there's a tendency to think that, you know, it was all perfect back then and we've kind of lost our way.
Mm.
You know, food waste on this mass kind of capitalist, globalized scale is, of course, a modern issue.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as wonderful as we might assume.
Mm.
You know, the other thing we could look at, if we look in the Victorian era, it is that there's kind of like a urban sort of salvaging market.
Yeah.
So people, richer households, would kind of sell the leftovers from their roast dinners or mm-hmm. the hare skin when they've had hair. But the people that are collecting that are very, very impoverished, and they're selling crumbs to people who are living in slums to live off, or stale bread and things like that. So of course, in one way they are saving those scraps, but that isn't a society that we would really emulate today.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's more complicated than just saying it was wasteful or it wasn't wasteful, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it goes also to the morality and of the past societies as well, like how moral was to waste, or how ethical was to waste the food back then, and how is that connected also to the religion, to Christianity, and what were the norms, basically? What was the church authorities, I would say, what would they say about these things?
Yeah, so it's certainly in the kind of Tudor era, bearing in mind this is when the Reformation has happened.
Mm.
So religion is, you know, is of a heightened importance or concern. And that religious outlook was really universal. So it's really no surprise that food was understood through a religious lens as something that's given by God. And, you know, it's the thing that sustained human or bodily life, you know, as opposed to spiritual or the afterlife. So it was seen as this great gift, and therefore to waste it was a great abuse and a sin even of that kind of heavenly gift. So, of course, that's tied with morality, you know, not letting the poor starve whilst the rich are eating these lavish meals and wasting it. Today, even maybe people are still aware of that biblical story, Lazarus and Dives, when it's the rich man who refuses to give the scraps from his meal to the beggar, and then he's denied heaven, basically. So people were certainly taught then through sermons not to waste their food, but because, you know, it could go to people who were starving.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, so I think this globalized food system today, which it can be very efficient in many ways, we tend to exploit all the different individual parts rather than trying to bring them together and feed all people, just exploit them for profit, I suppose. And then it means that a lot of people starving when there's surplus in food in other places. And also we underuse our own food, its country, let's say, its country's food security systems, in a sense. And we're relying in further and further away for feeding the citizens of a country. And it's very prominent now in UK as well. I mean, you hear about deals with Australia or New Zealand or whatever, and Canada, and it's like, but why don't we try and grow the food here and get some food security in a world that is very fragmented?
Yeah, so that's a big issue, isn't it? It's, you know, the modern food industry tends to be, well, like capitalism, really. It's based on getting the cheapest price, right? Getting more of our food grown abroad and transported across the world, and all the damage that causes.
I'll be back after this short break.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I mean, let's talk about this later on. Let's go back a little bit again. So the next chapter talks about the invention of tin can, right? And we are in an era of industrial and agricultural revolutions, and we are kind of in the 19th century now, and on that era, we have a lot of people trying to invent a way to preserve food for longevity, I suppose, right?
Yes, yeah. So I guess this chapter is really the start of that kind of cold chain, global cold chain that now gets us our food from across the world out of season. So it talks about how inventions in food preservation, one being artificially refrigerated ships, which is a bit later in the century, and the other being the tin can, how they helped people, whether that be, you know, explorers, colonists, you know, or transporters of food, travel further around the world and bring back food from elsewhere, and also transport our food across the world. The tin can is, perhaps we don't think of it like that today. It's sort of forget that tin cans are sort of just in the cupboard, aren't they? We don't really think much of them, really. We don't tend to think of it as our favourite food, I suppose. It's almost like emergency supplies, isn't it? But the tin can really revolutionised our ability to feed sailors and travellers, explorers who were, you know, travelling across the world, because it allowed to have access to more nutritious food that wasn't heavily salted. So before the tin can, you would have had very, very dry ship's biscuit, or you would have had a very, very heavily salted meat. Or if people were transporting meat across seas, they might have actually taken livestock, which was in high numbers wasted, essentially, because it's very dangerous for them to travel overseas. So on balance, it was this incredible invention. But of course, all in these inventions in food preservation actually came with a lot of waste. So there was a big scandal in the mid-19th century when Stephen Goldner, who had been supplying the British Navy with tin cans, they were found to be rotten, essentially. And so there's these awful stories of people going on these big excursions and then getting halfway, and then there's this awful stench, and it's because they've got rotten supplies. Yeah. And of course, that's, you know, it's essential for feeding yourself. So it was, you know, people died because of it as well. So it goes to like a Parliament Select Committee in the mid-19th century. And it's a big scandal. And people were, because of that, quite scared of the tinned food. And it does take a while then, you know, at least 50 years for it to start being sold really for household consumption.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like it is today, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, initially, I mean, we think about it now more like tinned tomatoes or beans and something like that. But it was a lot more to do with trying to preserve meat, I suppose, for these long journeys that they had stews and things like that in cans, right? If it's not cooked properly or if it's not sealed properly, and how do you keep the air airtight, and how do you cook it, and all that stuff, and then people getting poisoning, food poisoning or botulism, and then you scare the general population, and then that's that's a very good tactic for selling more more tin can food. So it took like at least until the end of the 19th century to become more of a, or even 20th century, right, to become more household.
Yeah, the start of the 20th century, really, yeah.
Well, with new techniques and new innovations on creating the cans themselves.
Yeah, I suppose it's like anything, it just takes a while for those methods to be perfected.
Yeah, on a similar era, so we have also the frozen food, as you mentioned, initially the refrigerated fridges, but then similar time, like the end of the 19th century, we have frozen food as well coming into vogue, in a sense. Do you remember the very first example of cargo traveling across the globe from one place to bring food?
Yeah, so these are experiments in artificial refrigeration in ships is in the 1870s, really. Mm-hmm. And primarily it's trying to ship meat from Australia and New Zealand, where they've got an excess of animals, especially sheep, to Britain. And again, that's another one. You know, there are successful ones, and, you know, that would have been incredible. Imagine it's traveled from the other side of the world. That really was revolutionary. But there were several examples when this didn't work. So 1873, there was a ship that had this new technology in it, trying to get from Melbourne to London, which ended up having 20 tons of mutton and beef, which was just completely gone off by the time it reached the UK. and then there's several examples of that. Those sort of unsuccessful missions.
Could you imagine being a sailor on that ship?
I know, it's just awful. And there's some that don't even, you know, leave the port because the refrigerant explodes everywhere and there's ammonia everywhere, which of course is dangerous.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's incredible. And again, we rely on it so much today, not just the ships, but then there has to be refrigerated kind of areas at the port where it can be stored before it goes off to shops and whatever. We rely on that so much, but, you know, it's really quite a modern invention. But, you know, over time in the Victorian era, this meant that people would start having access to cheaper meat that had come from the other side of the world.
Yeah, we kind of think it as a given now. It wasn't at all, roughly 150 years more or less, that becomes a bit more common. For example, this advert from Bird's Eye for frozen food. I mean, it's hard to imagine how much of a novelty frozen food was and how much of a difference made in product transported from the other side of the world, and how the boundaries of fresh and frozen product can be blurred nowadays.
And that's the news from Bird's Eye. Seafood frozen fresh from the sea. This new vacuum-sealed cooking pack makes it possible. Let's Bird's Eye bring you seafood this fresh with flavor this delicious. Look, fillet of flounder Amandine. Flounder caught off the coast of Newfoundland, filleted and quickly frozen, then vacuum sealed fresh. You cook it this easy. See, actually bastes itself to golden goodness. Open. Seafood fresh from the sea in butter sauce with lemon and white wine. Try all five new seafood dishes from Bird's Eye.
And then obviously refrigeration for the house itself, it's a later invention.
Yes, yeah. Invented, I suppose, with all these things, there's a kind of debate about who's the first to invent it. But it doesn't end up in households in the UK, at least, until really, the end of the 20th century, which is really, really recent. People who were born or who grew up, post-war, it wouldn't have been, you would have put your milk in the pantry, or it just wouldn't have been part of your daily life.
Yeah, true. Do we know who invented the first fridge, let's say?
Like I say, there's a lot of debate, but the first kind of commercial household fridge is 1913, I believe.
Right.
But like I say, it takes a long time for it to be actually usable within the household. And there's loads, the story of artificial refrigeration, it really does, it goes back into the Tudor era when they're experimenting with understanding what artificial coldness is. And there's a story of someone, a scientist, who dies from stuffing a chicken basically with snow and ends up dying from pneumonia.
Right.
So it goes back that far. And then throughout history, it's this big debate. And, even Einstein invents a fridge at one point, which is quite revolutionary, but which isn't a commercial success.
Yes, you say about that fridge, which doesn't use electricity and it doesn't use ammonia. So it was...
Yeah, that was the big thing, that refrigerants would leak. And they were fatal. So he came up with a way, essentially, of not having to use those types of chemicals. But like I say, the type of fridge that we ended up with is very different.
Yeah,
and that technology is still changing all the time.
I'm just trying to imagine a fridge that doesn't use some electricity as we use today, because it's a very energy consumptive device, or leaking ammonia. And what if that was the invention that was successful commercially? It would be a lot better for the environment as well.
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
There's another thing like that, I believe. With the toilets, for example, like on the 19th century when they invented the toilets and the whole system in London, right? That there was a system that was supposed to have two different waste pipes, one for liquid and one for solids. So they would be separated from the household. So you could use the solids for manure. But that was more expensive system. And they had all the manure from the horses and the animals. So they didn't go for it, I believe. Yeah. And then obviously 20th century comes and we have cars. So you don't have manure. So you have to find, where do you find nitrogen? So you have to invent artificial systems for that. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like what could have been? Yeah, again, yeah, that has to do with waste as well. I mean, we kind of very much related. So yeah, at the same time with all these inventions and revolution and early 20th century, we also have the wars. We have two big world wars. And you talk on your book about that, right?
Yes. So after kind of looking at the Victorian era and that kind of food waste kind of economy that develops, I then go into the World Wars. So just before the World Wars, I think we were sort of becoming a bit wasteful. And then suddenly you get this block on food, and suddenly it becomes this really hugely valuable thing again. Needlessly wasting food that could have been eaten by people was actually made illegal. Rationing's introduced, of course, in both wars. And then just the way that people approach food who were on the at home, all leftovers were just reused, either in thrifty dishes, things like using stale crust to coat food for frying, things like that. Or you could, the food waste would have been collected to be made into non-food related items for the war effort. So glycerin or extracted fat would go on to make fertilizers, but also glue for aeroplanes and even explosives. So there was these huge drives to collect leftovers for these purposes or to feed to pigs. And then, of course, you've got this valuable meat supply.
Yeah.
And the same, not just with food waste, but kind of kitchen waste more generally. So kitchen scrap, old pots and pans and things like that were collected, especially by the Women's Voluntary Service. So women who, it's an incredibly important job in the wars that was perhaps not recognised so much. But teaching people how to reuse their food waste, use up their leftovers, and physically collecting any salvage was a huge part of the war effort.
Okay. Yeah, we kind of know a little bit about World War II and the rationing afterwards, and we know how much there was a lot of government and state effort, people to grow their own food, dig for victory and all that stuff. We have all that stuff. And then we arrive in a situation after World War II and after rationing that we have seemingly a lot more abundance of food due to the industrial big innovations that happened, and they were implemented in our food systems. And obviously, coming out of the war, you don't want the memories of poverty and hunger are fresh. So yeah, there is an abundance of food.
Yes, exactly. So you suddenly get this, people just don't want to think about being frugal anymore. So yeah, it's this kind of hopeful era. And it's led by the United States because they're the only country that come out sort of profitable from the war. And, you know, they're selling this, they've got fridges in their households. And so they sort of sell this idea to people in Britain and Europe of kind of abundance.
Mm. And with that abundance comes waste.
Comes waste, definitely, yeah.
In your book, you then kind of going into that era, to the new era, and your chapter is called McDonald's, Punks and Food Anarchists. What can you tell us about that era?
Yeah, so that chapter is really, I think, where we start recognising the world that I'm describing. So it's the rise of fast food, which is wasteful in its quest to be non-wasteful, but only when that's to do with profit,
right?
So they'll throw away the chickens that aren't productive, but are making, the highest amount of profit that they can. It's also the rise of things like artificially produced new strains of crops, which are, again, highly productive, but then very damaging to the environment in other ways. The rise of use of artificial fertilizers, that sort of thing. So I kind of telling that story, the increase in waste in general. So it's like, I think it's 1970, by 1970, food waste had doubled from pre-World War II levels. So it really is this big boom. You also get supermarkets. So people stop sort of going to the local shops to get what they need every day and start feeling like there's this endless abundance. They start shopping bigger shops, but so less often, And then, of course, they've got starting to have refrigeration as well, which is an amazing food preserver, but at the same time leads to the wasteful behaviour because, like we do today, you can kind of just fling it in the fridge and you almost forget about it.
Yeah.
You think it's kind of got endless shelf life, which it, of course, hasn't. So I'm tracing that kind of the rise of, this kind of modern, mass-produced, globalised food system. But at the same time, it's about the countercultural movements that emerge to fight this. So there's the new environmentalist movement, which begins in the 1970s, which is trying to draw people's attention to the damages of these new crop strains that are, you know, highly dependent on these fertilizers and other
pesticides,
insecticides, other chemicals, and the damage that that does, and ultimately the waste that produces in its quest to be non-wasteful, if you see what I mean. Punks as well, people who go sifting through dustbins to find leftover food. So yeah, it's the tale of both that accumulation of food waste and also our fight against it in the modern era.
Yeah, they kind of emerge at the same time.
Yeah,
you have the counter movement on this continuous food waste and this abundance that seems to be almost excessive. You have all these movements coming out of that, trying to say, okay, that's not sustainable the long term. And talking about pesticides and insecticides and all that, I mean, that's a very important subject. I mean, throughout humanity, the food was wasted even before it went to the table of humans, right? I mean, you had all these pests whenever you had a farm and you were growing whatever you were growing. You had slugs and snails and rats and insects. So food was wasted anyway in the past, and people always tried to find ways to counter that with either poisons or traps or whatever, and just became more efficient, I suppose, in our modern era. a lot more food didn't get wasted that way, but wasted in another way.
Exactly. That's exactly it, yeah. So, another thing is the rise of the monocultures. So we used to have much more varied strains of different types of crops. But the problem is then if, as what happened with the banana, they get infected with a strain, then they can't fight it off because it's a monoculture. There isn't a genetic diversity. And so actually we used to have a whole different type of banana that we used to eat globally, which got completely wiped out. And then now we have, according to most historical accounts, a less tasty banana, less sweet banana, the Cavendish banana, which is now the one that is what we mean when we say banana. It's just this one monoculture. But that is also very vulnerable to viruses and the rot. So again, it's kind of not wasteful in a way. You know, we might have made plants that are more productive for less space, or that have less wasteful bits, you know, of seeds or things like that, that we consider to be wasteful. But actually, this modern food system leaves us open to other types of food waste.
Yeah. And what is the future? Because I think you explore that a little bit in your book, right?
I do, yes. So it is a history, but like I say, because it kind of builds up to these modern problems, I felt like it would be remiss not to sort of think about, well, what does this mean? Can we kind of look back to the past as something we can learn from or not? And, you know, what's being done at the present? And I do think it's a tough to feel like we can make a difference, you know, without a big system overhaul, without, like I say, kind of tackling that globalized food system on a global scale with government action, but also international action. So on the one hand, I do think, you know, the authorities will listen if we show that we care enough about it. But the other thing is just day-to-day ordinary people, we can just change our attitude to food. You know, if you realize that actually the abundance in supermarkets is an illusion, you know, that we need to reconnect with the true labor and cost that go into producing our food, you know, perhaps then we'd waste less of it. If you think that one orange uses up 50 liters of water to produce it,
wow,
that it's grown in fields that are lavish with pesticides and artificial fertilizers, that it's transported across skies at every point using gas guzzling machines, using fridges, etc., etc. If you really truly understand that and kind of become knowledgeable about the food that you eat, perhaps, you know, we would waste less. And for me, the actual act of writing a history about it, but I hope also for people reading the history about it, I hope that will kind of hit home that in the past these were real people who had to labor to grow their food, who had to preserve it, you know, etc., etc. Perhaps that alone is enough to sort of change our individual attitudes towards food. It's more fun as well. It's more exciting if you enjoy the pleasures of eating, but also growing food and also constructing dishes or reimagining leftovers into something exciting. You know, actually, there's a lot of fun that can be had with that. It's not just this kind of boring, I don't know, sort of like poverty, impoverished. You know, like you can have fun with.
Yeah, you can see it as something miserable and soul destroying. You can embrace it and say, a bit of fun, what can I do with these leftovers and how can I make them more interesting?
Exactly.
That requires, I guess, a bit of effort initially on the part of the individual. But I think the more you do it, the easier it becomes. It's like, okay, now I have the know-how and the experience and I can make my dinner better very easily with and use all these leftovers and so on and so on, which is fun. But I mean, in terms of individuals, we do waste food, and if you accumulate that, it's huge. But the supermarkets and the big industries, they have huge, much, 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 much bigger wastage of food, right?
Yeah, well, so it's 70% in the UK is in households. So household food waste is the biggest producer of waste altogether. Mm. But you're right that you need mass change at a kind of a wider level for sure. And actually, the supermarkets now are kind of signed up to projects that do help them reduce their food waste in general. So there is hope in that sense.
Lovely. Just to talk a bit about the past, generally, even very far to Doria or whenever you have some. Do you have any interesting facts about food waste from the past? Do you have something that, like, I remember reading in the book about William Shakespeare's father getting some fines? Do you have a couple of these examples to tell us, to give us?
Sure. Yes, well, so William Shakespeare's father, his name was John, and so he was a curer of white leather and a glover, so he made gloves. And those types of professions, along with the butchers, were really notorious for polluting streets with the scrapings of fat from the animal skins or blood and other leftover kind of animal products. So we know about him from a fine that survives from 1552 for polluting the streets in Stratford. Because even back then, there were laws introduced to get people to send that type of waste to muck hills outside of the city, because of course it was a health concern to have all this animal bits thrown into the streets.
Yeah, rotting all the streets.
Yeah. Other interesting kind of facts from the book. I find it really interesting looking at modern foods that are actually made from what was once considered waste. Mm. So Marmite is one. I know, love it or hate it. Some people hate it, but some people love it. But even if you hate it, it's still interesting that it was actually invented in the early 20th century as a way of using up wasted yeast from a brewery nearby.
Yes, yes.
Which makes sense. And even skimmed milk in Edwardian England, it was seen as a waste product. It was a thing that you would just feed it to the pigs, or you'd even just pour it down drains. Because what they thought was the valuable thing was the fattier milk, creamier milk. So it was only in World War II, actually, that was kind of accepted as a drink in its own right. So yeah, I find that fascinating.
Yeah, that's very interesting because, yes, nowadays same skimmed milk is everywhere.
Yeah, and if anything, we value it more, right, because we're more conscious of health and we think it's healthier for us.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a lesson in, another thing to kind of, that I gained from the book is changing your attitude, right, to what waste is. A big one is thinking about eating animals. I think today we're very, very squeamish, aren't we, about what bits of the animal we deem to be edible.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, it was a delicacy in the past to have, you know, feet and tongue and things like that.
Yeah, brawn, the whole head. Yeah.
So maybe there's a case as well for rediscovering those types of foods and wasting less in the process. Again, perhaps in a fun way, not in this like negative way that
absolutely
is often framed as. You know, it is a book that celebrates food ultimately.
Yeah.
And yeah, the different tastes and discoveries that are part of this history of food waste.
Great. I guess the readers should take that home. Yeah, when they read the book. Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time today, Eleanor.
You're welcome. It was really interesting talking to you.
And tell us again when the book is out and where people can find it.
Yeah, so it's out on the 14th of March. And yeah, you can find it wherever you find your books, hopefully.
And it's out from Head of Zeus, right?
Head of Zeus, yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you. Have a lovely day.
You too. I hope you have some nice food, nice leftovers.
Yes, actually, I will. Well, that's all for today. Thanks to Eleanor Barnett for her time, and I hope you found this discussion fascinating and thought-provoking. Her new book comes out tomorrow. It's called Leftovers, A History of Food Waste and Preservation, and it's out by Head of Zeus. Remember, if you like this podcast, please rate and review and become a Patreon subscriber. This podcast wouldn't exist without your generous support. So, thank you very much and see you soon.
Hi. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.